This is Cave Scott Allen of OTCode.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from LazyCoder.com.
Welcome to this episode of Herding Code, being recorded on January 13th, 2010. Tonight's guest is Sean Chambers. He's a senior software developer at ACI and also an open source developer. One of the reasons we wanted to have him on the show was to talk about one of the projects he's been working on, Fluent Migrator, which is Fluent Migrations for .NET. So Sean, can you tell a bit about what this is?
Sure. Fluent Migrator is a migration framework for .NET that is a port from Rails migrations, if you've ever used that. What it's used for is for versioning your database. So when you have a particular set of changes to your schema, the idea is that you create a class to encapsulate these changes, and we have a Fluent API to allow you to build up a set of changes. And then what you can do is you can run them from either a NAND script, console. We have Rake support, a couple different ways that you can do it. And then what that will do is it'll go ahead and version your database from one version to the next, and you can go forward in versions, backward in versions. You can jump to a specific version. You can seed data, all these types of things. And it just easily, it greatly simplifies managing your database as you're going through successive versions of it. There's a couple of books that recommend this as a good approach and that type of thing. And of course, the Rails guys have been doing it for quite a while. This tool is actually a port of another. It's actually quite an interesting story of how this framework came about. Do you want me to go into detail on this now, or wait until we get further in? Or
no, I was going to ask how did this come about?
Okay, so originally, I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name correctly, Marc-André Coriner. I'm not sure. I probably butchered that. Marc-André was a fellow developer that kind of threw patches into the Castle project back in, this is probably 2004 or 2005, whenever the Castle project first came around with Monorail and all that stuff. He originally created a migration framework that was inspired by Rails migrations called Migrator.net. This framework, at one point, it was rolled up into Castle Project, and then it was removed from Castle Project. And then eventually he went over to the Rails camp, to the Ruby camp, got a full-time job there, and migrated.NET probably sat around for a year or so without anybody touching it. About a year later, somebody else, I forget his name, picked it up, dumped it into Google Code. And then at that point, I came along, and me and him both picked it up and started to add features to it. We built a Fluent API around it and such. And that went along for quite a while. The problem with migrator.net was that there was no semantic model built into it. So when you were running the migrations, as soon as you executed the migration, it sent that off to the database right away. So there was no inspection you could do of the migrations that needed to be done on the database. So it was kind of limiting in that approach.
Could you explain that a little bit more?
As far as the semantic model, not having the semantic model there?
Right.
What happened with migrator.net is whenever you did your statements, like let's say you had create table this and create table this and add column this, as soon as the parser came across each of those commands, it would execute the SQL statement to whatever database we're using, create this table, add this column. That was a great limitation of migrator.net, and in its core, that was the most glaring thing that could have been improved, but it would have required an entire rewrite of the project. So when we first started working on Fluent Migrator, we came to the conclusion that it would be much better if we had, since it really is a DSL for creating database versioning, if we built in a semantic model. And basically what the semantic model is it's a Fluent API to building up an object model. And then you can take this object model that you build and go ahead and pass it and inspect it and do different things with it. That's what a semantic model is. I believe the term was coined by Fowler. He mentions in a bunch of his books. I think it's in Enterprise Application Architecture. I don't recall. But I think he has an upcoming DSL book. It's in there and such like that. Or you can search for his DSL work in progress book online, and it goes into depth about exactly what it is. So by that point, myself and Nate Kohari were working together at Intelligent, and we came up and said, it'd be a cool idea if we could kind of do a port of migrator.net over to a new framework and build a semantic model in this, and we do some cool stuff with it. And to Nate's credit, Nate did a lot of the core stuff in Fluent Migrator fairly quickly. And then at that point, Justin Etheridge and myself came along and we added tests and a lot of the outlying things that needed to be built in order to get it to work. And then at that point, it sat for probably about 6 months, at which point two other gentlemen, Josh Hoffman and Steve Hodgkiss, came along and they actually finished out Fluent Migrator to get it actually running and working. So they were a big help. I mean, they really took it full circle and actually got it working. And then at that point, I finally came back around and I could start using it in my current job, because we had a need for it. So since then, we've added some support for, it already had SQLite and SQL Server support. I've added MySQL and PostgreSQL support, and also a couple other fringe benefits like, you know, NAT support and things like that. Mm-hmm. So that's the basic gist of what we've done with it. And of course, there's other things that we can go into if you want, or if you want more explanation.
I was maybe just looking for a scenario. So let's say I'm on a development team, or I'm a developer by myself, and I'm not doing any version control on my database, or maybe I already am, but I'm just generating SQL scripts and running those by hand. So moving over to use Fluent Migrator, whenever I want to make a change to my database, I essentially create a class that derives from a base migration class, and then use the Fluent API that's defined to describe the changes that I want to apply to the database.
Yep, that's correct.
Right, so far, right? And then you would build that into an assembly, and then something, you know, you can have scripts that actually execute the changes that you have described in there.
Yep. So there's actually, when you derive from that base class, which is just called migration, mm-hmm. It requires that you implement two methods. One method's called up and the other one's called down. Whenever you tell Fluent Migrator, whenever you invoke it from either NAT or we have rake support in there, so you can run it from rake or the command line, you tell it what version you want to go to. If you don't specify a version, it'll just go to the latest version that it finds in that assembly. What it does then is, let's say you're at version, let's say your database is just an empty database, nothing's in it, no tables, and you have five versions in your assembly. Each version would require a new class to be added to your migration assembly, so to speak. So you would have, you know, migration one, create users table, migration two, create, you know, employee table, so on and so forth. And in each of those classes, you'd have, in the up methods and create people, you'd have create table users, and the second one you'd have create table people. What happens then is you tell Fluent Migrator, okay, we want to take this fresh database here and go to the latest version of whatever is in the assembly. What it'll do then is it'll parse through the assembly and say, okay, I found five migrations. And then what it'll do is it'll run through and go version one up, version two up, version three up, version four up, version five up. And at that point in time, it stores a table on your database, just a single table with a version number in it, that will then indicate that database is on version 5. And then in the down methods, you actually do the exactly opposite. So you can say, I want to go from version 5 to version 0. And then what it'll do is it'll do the opposite and do, you know, migration 5 down, migration 4 down, migration 3 down, 2 down, 1 down, so forth, and bring it all the way back to an empty database. So in each of the downs, you'd have delete table persons, delete table, you know, users, so on and so forth. The going reverse is destructive, so you would lose all the data that associated with that. We use that a lot when we're pushing out to like a development test server or QA or something like that, and we want to first undo all the changes to that database and repave it all over again. We'll first roll back everything and then we'll roll forward. So that's a situation that we use those types of migrations.
And it looks like the API has a pretty good coverage of things you'd want to do with SQL Server. You know, just looking through the one example, you can create columns with different data types, make them nullable, not nullable, create clustered indexes, non-clustered indexes, create foreign keys, even insert data.
Actually, the insert data one is one that's garnered a little bit more attention recently, because that's one area that we didn't spend a lot of time in, and it's one area that I find that I've had to spend a lot of time in the last couple weeks. So with the insert data, I added a couple of conventions there to, if you want to set a working directory of where it should look for all your seed data scripts. And there's probably a couple other features that can be added there. As I'm going along, I'm kind of adding to the stack of things that we should add there. But the insert data is useful when you do want to insert, like, let's say, you know, a states table with 50 states in it, rather than write a migration that says, you know, insert, you know, row state Florida, insert row state Washington. That can get really repetitive, and it's easier just to feed it a bunch of seed data to do that stuff. So that's where those insert SQL ones come in useful.
Now, I noticed that you've also got support for SQLite. Is that is that full support? Is that, I mean, obviously there's different data types in SQL Server, but is it you know, fully implemented?
Yep. So certain aspects may or may not be supported. So for instance, if you're doing MySQL, there's a little bit different handling on how it handles. I believe it was the GUIDs are a little bit different as to how it handles them. Like in SQL Server, they're a unique identifier. In MySQL, they're a little bit different how MySQL handles them. Same with SQLite. There's certain nuances that each database does or does not support. What we do is we have these the notion of what we call them processors in Fluent Migrator, and a processor is an implementation of an actual a database type. So we have a SQL Server processor, a SQLite processor, and we have a visitor pattern around that. So basically what happens is the generator looks at all the migrations to be done and then walks a visitor and says, okay, whatever processor you are, give me the SQL required to do this type of expression that I found in the migration. And that's the translation boundary that then the SQL Server knows that, okay, I need to do an insert into yada yada, and does a translation however it needs to. In instances where we don't support something, basically we just don't return a statement from that so that it's never ran. And in certain other instances, we've found that we've had to actually throw exceptions. Like you're trying to create, you know, I'm trying to think of an instance now where I ran into this, but in certain instances, you can't do certain things. Like in PostgreSQL, for instance, if you try to create, I think it was a primary key on any column type other than an int 32, it kind of freaks out, or it was something along those lines of a quirk that it had. So in certain instances, it may or may not support what it is that you're trying to do. But we do have a translator and kind of like a mapper. So what we're doing is we're using the DB types in .NET framework to map into whatever database it is that you're using.
So what's the big advantage of doing this in code versus just writing out the T-SQL scripts and calling them kind of in order, you know, right? Just writing a bootstrapper that would do this. Usually when people make an argument for either writing JavaScript or T-SQL or whatever, some kind of abstraction or fluent interface in C# around it, it's due to the refactoring and the being able to harness the power of the IDE to modify your code and treat it, you know, more like data. But it doesn't seem like you're going to be doing lots of refactoring or anything like that within, you know, a migration class. So I'm just wondering what the benefit is of doing this in this way versus, you know, just writing a 30-line, you know, console app that'll go through and just iterate over T-SQL scripts in a directory and execute them in order.
So the main benefit I feel that you get from doing this type of thing is the ability to go to different versions in your database. So for instance, let's say when I'm deploying out, I'm done working on my dev machine and I push everything into source control, and then I want to deploy that to a dev environment so that other people can see it or PMs or whoever. What I can do then is I can say, okay, let's say I only want to section off these changes that I made today or whatever the instance is. And this dev database, I'm not going to want to do all the migrations. I'm only going to want to do halfway. I can say, okay, just go to version 3 because I know that you're only going to need those changes to get up where I want you to be. So maybe that's one instance. I haven't really run into an instance where I've had to do something like that. But another positive is, and this isn't actually fully implemented in Fluent Migrator, but I could see this as being a benefit, is when I want to roll back to, let's say I'm on version 5 and I want to roll back to version 1, one of the things that we can harness that we're not really harnessing yet is, since we have a semantic model and we can make assumptions about, let's say when you're going forward a version, you say create table users. because we have a semantic model and we can look at the expressions that we create and say, okay, when you're going up, you're doing a create table. So if that's the only one that's in there, I can make the assumption that when you're going in the reverse direction, I'm going to make the assumption that you want to delete table people or delete table users or whatever it is. So on that note, some of the down migrations for undoing the changes, you don't have to really write in this situation because the framework can make assumptions about what it is that you're wanting to do to go in the reverse direction. With using the straight T-SQL scripts, it's a little bit harder to go in a reverse direction because once you pave it one way, you really can't go in reverse. You have to just completely nuke the database, you know, and start over again and just say, go to the latest version. But you can do this, or like plenty of places I've been at, we have had, you know, most places do just use T-SQL scripts with maybe a little, you know, executable or a bat file to say, okay, like you said, run all the T-SQLs in this directory. But I've seen that you kind of run into problems with that in certain instances, but I would say that they're edge case and maybe not enough to warrant switching all of your T-SQL scripts to something like this. Another benefit that you do get from something like this is the statements to write, you know, say, I want to go to this or, you know, create this table with these columns. It's fairly terse in order to do that. I'm not sure about you guys. I don't really like writing, you know, repetitive SQL all the time, like insert into, or I forget the actual statement. So this becomes useful where you just say create dot table users. And that's pretty much it, rather than, you know, a 4 or 5 line SQL statement in order to create a table. In addition to that, and this is probably a really, and I've heard this argument before within Hibernate, and I have actually used it in one case, is that since I'm abstracting out the actual database that I'm using, this, just like within Hibernate, I can say, okay, I'm writing my migrations in a generic format, and I can then apply those to a MySQL database, a SQL Server database, and I don't have to rewrite all of my SQL scripts. In one instance that I had that I was using, at this point in time, I was using Migrator.net and Hibernate. I originally planned on using SQL Server, but it ended up that we actually had to deploy to a MySQL Server. And because I was using a migration framework and in Hibernate, it was as simple as flipping two configuration values and, you know, everything worked as expected for deploying to MySQL because I had completely abstracted myself away from the database.
So I guess my follow-up question would be, given those benefits, those same benefits exist in the Rails Active Record migrations. So I'm wondering why do this in .NET other than the kind of standard argument that that's what my team understands. Why not just use Rails migrations?
You can actually definitely do that. Actually, one of the other guys that works on Fluent Migrator, in his current job, he actually uses Rails migrations against SQL Server at his workplace. And he says it works good. He said they do have to fudge it a little bit to get it to work with SQL Server. But Rails migrations is completely agnostic, and you can use it against any database you'd like. So, I think if I wouldn't have had Fluent Migrator at the location I'm at now, I probably would have recommended that we use something like Rails migrations because it is pretty terse in its syntax and it is Ruby, and with Iron Ruby and everything, it makes it a little bit easier to use something like that.
So we had a question from Aaron Lurch on Twitter who wanted to know how Fluent Migrator would work in a project where you're also using Fluent and Hibernate. And he's worried about defining his database in both and worrying about possible differences.
That is actually a concern, and it's one that I'm not really sure if I have a good answer for, because of the reason the thing with the migrations is, and a while back, I think it was on one of the van meetings at virtualalt.net. That was kind of when we first started developing. I showed a couple people on the virtualalt.net. And at the time, I believe Chad and Jeremy Miller and Chad Myers were on there as well. And we were discussing it. And at the time, we were discussing, okay, can we plug this into Fluent and Hibernate at all and utilize the way that they're building up the mappings in Fluent and Hibernate? The problem with that is that once you create your migration, you're pretty much set in stone that at this point in time, this is what the database is going to look like. Fluent and Hibernate is built to change as your model changes, and that's why they're using the strongly typed reflection of the lambdas. So then if I use a rename refactoring, it'll go ahead and cascade into my mapping files. The thing with the migrations is that you don't want that to happen. If I rename a particular model to, change it from full name to first name, I don't want that reflected in the migration, because once the migration is set, it should be untouched. I shouldn't have to go back and touch that migration again. And because of that, and this is something that I've mulled over quite a bit, and Nate and Justin and all of us have kind of kicked around ideas to see if we can plug in and use it in some way. And I'm not sure that we can gain any usage from it other than maybe, looking at the mapping files that are generated from an Hibernate to create an initial migration, like kind of a baseline setup. That's kind of the only thing that I would see being useful in it, or a way that you could use it in accordance with, or along with Fluent and Hibernate. Other than that, I think they meet two different needs in your application. And even though they're both data-centric needs, I'm not sure you can match them up in a way like that. One thing that I kicked around for a while, and I'm still kicking around, is if we could use Fluent Migrator along with Fluent and Hibernate in some way to use it for, if you are using an Hibernate on your project, we're doing integration tests with an Hibernate where we just create a SQLite in-memory database, and then we run a bunch of tests against it, and then once the session is disposed, the SQLite database goes out of scope and is removed from memory. The thing with this, or the thing that we started to run into, is exactly what Aaron was saying, is the migrations, you'll find that will start to fall out of scope. If you have a baseline migration of all the things to initially set up the database, what happens is you may change a property or rename and it falls out of scope. So what we tried to start to do was make it so when our integration tests run, the first thing that happens is the SQLite database is created in memory, and then we actually run the Fluent Migrator migrations against it, and then run our Hibernate tests on top of that. And what that did was that flushed out any errors that we may have in a migration ahead of time when we were running our tests, rather than waiting for deployment to see it fail there. And that definitely cut down on a lot of the problems with that. And actually, a couple of patches I threw in there were specifically for that reason, so I could pass in an existing connection, because SQLite in memory is a little weird how it acts there. So. But that definitely is a problem. I'm not sure, if there's any way that it could plug into it. But
okay, yeah. So the answer is not that you cannot use both Fluent Migrator and Fluent and Hibernate in the same project. You can. It's just that they address different issues, and they don't necessarily can't find a good way to make them work together, right?
Yeah, definitely. I'm sure. I really feel that there at some area there is something that Fluent and Hibernate can provide to Fluent Migrator, and there's something that Fluent Migrator can provide to Fluent and Hibernate, because it feels like at some level there's something that both of the projects can use from each other. Mm-hmm. But I have yet to find it, and kicking ideas around with others, everybody's like, yeah, it seems like we can plug these things together, and I don't think anybody's actually come up with, hey, this is what we could do that could make this more useful, in your actual application. I'm thinking maybe around the lines of generating a baseline migration in the beginning, because a lot of times you'll create all your Fluent and Hibernate mappings, and what your model is going to look like, and then to maybe generate an initial baseline migration from that. One thing that Rails migrations does that Fluent Migrator doesn't do that would be a useful addition is every time you run your migration in Rails migrations, it has a schema file that they use to keep track of what your actual database looks like. And then you can take that schema file and apply it to a new server, and it'll basically do your baseline creation of your tables and columns. And this is one thing that Fluent Migrator doesn't do that we're kind of feeling pain around. And maybe if we use Fluent and Hibernate to say, okay, give us all of the mapping files so that we can create an initial schema from it, something along those lines, I could see being useful.
Well, so, and Hibernate has its own sort of schema evolution sort of model, where you can define all your mappings and then have it generate the SQL to generate the database, or generate the diff between the current mappings of your domain model and what's it currently in the database structure, which is just kind of a different approach to this stuff than the whole migrations model. And I'm wondering if you have a, you know, sort of compare and contrast perspective on why, you know, what are the benefits of one versus the other, or why would you want to use migrations versus, you know, the entire Hibernate model, or does each have their own strengths and weaknesses?
Yeah, we actually, that's called the schema export, which is in the configuration namespace of an Hibernator somewhere along there. And we currently use that in our integration test to create the schema before we run all our tests against the SQLite in memory. Schema export and schema update. I've never played with the schema update, but I do use the schema export. So I've never actually tried to apply the schema update to an actual application, but that would probably serve the same purpose of diffing, you know, okay, this is what your mapping looks like and this is what your schema looks like. The area that Fluent Migrator, I think, or migration frameworks in general really becomes beneficial is I have, okay, we went to development for version 1.0, and now we're working on version 1.1. We can create a separate assembly and say, okay, here's the 1.1 migrations, and here's everything that it consists of, which is 20 migrations and all these changes to the database, where something like that allows you to easily version and section off, okay, you know, if a client's on version 1.5 and we want to bring them back to 1.0, we know that we have to apply the migrations to, you know, apply them all the migrations in these assemblies. Okay, run the 1.5 migrations, the 1.4, so on and so forth, and allows you to easily package them up like that. But if you do have something like schema export, that definitely is an easy way. That would give you the initial dump of the SQL, I'm assuming, that would require to look at the model at that point. At that point, you would still then need to arrange your schema exports in a fashion that allows you to run them in sequence and such. But I haven't really played with those two features a lot other than outside of my integration tests that we're doing.
Well, I know schema update has got some major limitations that I know that covered your stuff would cover that their stuff doesn't. So I think that they could be complementary. But
the schema update, you feed it your models or your mappings and point to the database, and then it'll say, here's what's different between the two. Or I know the schema export, like just the initial schema creation, but what exactly does a schema update produce when you, or what's its parameters that you provide to it?
Right. So schema update will essentially generate the diff script that says, here's my current model, looks at the database and sees where they differ. But it, for example, it's entirely non-destructive, so it doesn't drop tables, doesn't drop columns. So it has some pretty big limitations in its current incarnation anyway.
I see.
Alrighty. Any more questions, guys? Who has questions?
Well, one of the sort of just theoretical issues that I've always thought about with the whole migrations approach is, as you evolve your schema, you can end up with these sort of intermediate points in your schema evolution that you don't keep. In other words, in version 1, you've added a table, and in version 10, you drop that table. And that always seemed to be a little bit messy, because now you're sort of creating these transient objects that don't end up living in the sort of final version of the schema. Is that a real problem? Is there things that you guys do to manage that sort of issue?
So could you explain a little more exactly, like, you create the tables in the first version, then version 10 would define, okay, I want to drop it in this version, or I'm not sure what you're...
Yeah. So, you know, in version 1, you know, as you've been evolving your schema, in version 1, you add some column to a table, and in version 7, you drop that column. And then in version 8, you add a table, and in version 11, you drop that table. And so in order to evolve to the final database schema, aren't you creating all these weird intermediate stages that you don't actually need?
Yes, actually, that is a very good point, because then what you're actually doing is exactly what you're saying. You're saying, okay, I know, and this is actually a very valid gripe and a valid problem, is that you're saying, you know, just like you stated, in version 2, I'm adding a column, and then in version 4, I'm removing that column, and in version 6, I may be adding that column back again. That's what Rails migrations does to combat that, the best that I understand of how why it's doing this is whenever you run a new migration and it's, you know, passed to the interpreter or whatever it is in Rails migrations that processes these things, it will look at every migration from the first one to the most current one, and that's when it generates a schema RB file that accurately reflects what the database looks like for you to at the most recent migration. So what that does is it keeps your schema in sync and saying, okay, if you go to the most recent version, this is what your schema is going to look like. But that still doesn't address the fact that in between these two versions, you will have a table there that you'll add, and then you'll go to version 10 and you'll drop. So that is a good question, and I haven't really dove into how Rails migrations handles this, but they have some things in there. They came across the same problem, and that's why they're doing this schema dump every single time you run the migration. And they figured out a way to solve this, although I don't really have a good answer for it other than that Rails migrations does do something along those lines. I'm assuming what they do is they probably look at all the migrations, and then anything that's added in one version and then dropped in a later, they don't even bother adding to the schema dump. So basically they're doing a schema dump of a cumulative of all of the migrations so that you don't have to do this intermediate if you want to just set up the database and, you know, get to the latest version. I don't know if that's a good answer or not for that.
No, that makes sense. But you're saying Rails does that, but Fluent Migrator does not do that?
No, it doesn't. And this is actually one feature that I've noticed that we've, you know, run into from time to time. And it's definitely one that I think if we could carve off a one big feature that's not in Fluent Migrator yet that would be useful, it would be that feature, because I see that one in Rails migrations and we don't have it yet. And I think that solves that problem. In other locations, when I was at Telligent, we had something not a migration framework, but we had T-SQL scripts that we'd run, and we ran into the same problem with those, is that you would have, you know, at the beginning of a release, you would add a couple of columns to a table, and then, you know, a month or two into the release, we would remove those columns, and what would happen is we would have all this data being pushed into tables and pulled out of tables, and tables being renamed or moved around. And then at a later version of a T-SQL script, they're just dropped off and removed. So we saw the same problem there when we were just using straight T-SQL scripts. And it's definitely a valid problem. I guess the consolation for that is that you're not really running the migrations all that often. So, you know, you're doing it once when you're deploying or, you know, going to the latest version. So it shouldn't be that, shouldn't really be a performance problem or anything like that. But it definitely is. You're just doing all these extra migrations for the sake of doing them, even though they're going to undo things later on. So
just kind of curious what kind of extensibility hooks you might have in there. Like if someone wants to, let's say they want to create a column with a data type that's not in the library just yet, like one of the geospatial types or something, could they define a new class for that? Or would that be something where they'd have to submit a patch or fork it to get that done?
At the current moment, we don't have anything that allows us to pull in. So basically, our whole semantic model is all derives from one interface, and then we have a couple interfaces to control the Fluent API that we want to control as you're building up the migration or the actual expression. It actually would be fairly trivial to add that hook because you just have to provide your assembly that wherever you have an iExpression in, and then we can pull those into our assembly and then, or look at your one for additional expressions that we can include in, and then you make that available to you. Maybe some caveats there, but at the current moment in time, we don't have any hooks in order to do that. But what we do have is it's pretty straightforward and fairly simple to modify the semantic model. It's organized really well, and it's not really documented too well like most open source projects, but it's pretty simple in how it's structured, that we have a generator for each database, a processor for each database, and then the semantic model. And then there's also we call them DB maps, and that defines what data type will map into, what data type on the database will map into what DB type in the .NET framework. So As far as that's concerned, the only limitation is that you have to have you have to be using one of the DB types that's defined in the .NET framework, because everything in there is based off of that. Mm-hmm. So if you're not using one of those, it may be a little bit trickier in order to get that in there. But if you can dumb it down to one of those in order to get it in and then pass it along to the database in that manner, then you'd be able to do that. That's probably the biggest area of limitation that people would probably run into, because for something like this, you can create one-off, I want to, push something to SQL Server that maybe these two other databases don't support. Something like that may get a little bit trickier because we're handling it generically that, you create a migration, it'll work on SQL Server, PostgreSQL, MySQL, SQLite, and pretty soon, hopefully, Oracle and other database types. So special cases may be a little bit trickier, although we haven't really run into many yet. I'm not sure if we actually have that many users of the tool as of this moment. I know I'm using it. The two other main committers, I don't think either of them are using it at the moment. A couple other people are using it that I've heard on Twitter or looking at migration frameworks. So I'm not sure if we're getting many feature requests because nobody's really using it other than myself. But
well, maybe that'll change.
Yeah, it's definitely useful for us for straightforward things. You're just creating tables, adding tables, seeding data. I think people may get in a little bit of trickiness or run into a snag here or there when you try to do a special case thing. But it's definitely extensible to the point that we can add any patches in and people can pull this down and take a look at it, because the API part of building up the migrations is pretty well segregated off to the side that people can grok it pretty easily.
So one of the things that I'm curious about, and I haven't actually gotten to look at the project, and once you have your second kid, you'll understand why, is how this handles store procedures and user functions and custom user types and things like that. Because I know that, what's in vogue now is to not, store procedures are evil and everything like that. And if you're not using an ORM, you're stealing from your employer. But there's a lot of times, specifically in reporting scenarios, where you need things like functions. And they really do simplify your stored procedures so they don't end up being, 1,000-line behemoths. And you need stored procedures and views and whatnot to kind of flatten out your database, whether you're using a relational or any of the kind of database I've found. So I'm just wondering how Fluent Migrator and any of the others, how they handle things like sprocs and user functions and views and things like that.
Yeah, so we actually ran into this a little bit, and where we were using, if anybody's familiar with the, I'm sure a lot of people are familiar with the ASP.NET membership system of registering users and such like that. One thing we ran, so creating sprocs should be, you should just be able to dump that into a SQL file or, an actual T-SQL script, and then you can load those into Fluent Migrator just by saying insert from script, or I'm trying to remember what the part of the API is, but it's under the insert part of the API. You can do insert.sql script or something like that, or execute SQL script, and most sprocs should be able to fit under that umbrella. We did run into problems with the ASP.NET membership system, because I don't know if you guys use or have looked at the ASP.NET membership system, that it has like 20 tables that it has to create, and it's got all these, I think the 50 or 60 sprocs it puts in, and all this craziness that it does. And what happens is, because we're pulling in the SQL script, we're opening up the SQL script file, and then we're reading the contents of the SQL script and passing that to a SQL command. If you have, at the current moment in time, and I'm not saying that this isn't patchable or fixable, it's just I haven't put the time into it yet. When you run into certain statements that are not, I don't know what the proper terminology here is, but if it's not, T-SQL standard, like if you have a go statement in one of your scripts that's specific to SQL Server and the SQL command, when you try to pass that through a SQL command as query text, it'll actually barf on that and throw an exception and say, I don't know what the hell this is. I'm not going to run this. And we actually ran into that. So the current moment of time when we had to deal with those is we had to push those off to the side and run that as another step in our deployment process and pass that directly to the command line tool, whatever the latest one is, or osql.exe. And I think there's a newer one that they have now. But in instances like that, you may run into snags when, if you have a pretty complex SPROC or something along those lines that you have to install into the database. If it's a simple SPROC, and you can definitely try it and see if it works, but you may catch your elbow on one or two things there that we've run into once or twice. The easier way to solve that would be somehow to, whenever we load in the SQL script that contains the SPROC to create or the function to create, we would then have to pass it to a command line tool like OSQL to actually execute that script. So in certain instances, I think you will hit a brick wall with if you have a special case that you need to set up in the database. And at that point, I would say that a migration is really for creating your tables and your columns and even inserting simple data. And anything beyond that, like creating SPROCs, creating functions, things along those lines, may get a little bit too in-depth in order to put into a migration framework like this. I think you'll find yourself hitting a brick wall here or there when you're trying to do that. And we've definitely run into a couple.
So I was curious, you know, we talked about how this relates to other migration frameworks. One other one that I've looked at in the past is subsonic migrations. And I wondered if you'd looked at or used that at all, how that relates.
Actually, I haven't looked at subsonic migrations. I actually wasn't aware that Rob had a migration framework in there. Amazingly, there is quite a few, and I wish I compiled a list. There's probably at least 5 or 10 migration frameworks in .NET. Amazingly, they don't get a lot of attention. I think there is, there's, I didn't know, I wasn't aware that there was a subsonic migrations. The guys at Headspring, Jimmy Bogard and Eric Hexter and all them, they have one called Tino migrations, because all of their projects like Tarantino, they have a Tino migrations or something along those lines that they have that they use internally. There's migrator.net. There's RIC migrations, R-I-K. I believe that's how you pronounce it, RIC migrations. I think there's one or two other frameworks out there that do migrations. I've played with, of course, migrator.net and Fluent Migrator. I have not looked at subsonic migrations. I looked very briefly at RIC migrations. I know that the RIC migrations one handles it in the same manner that migrator.net does, in which as soon as you say create table users, it will fire off a SQL statement on the fly and kick that off right away. There's no semantic model there to inspect in order to generate the SQL statements that are required, like migrator.net. I'm not sure how he's doing it in subsonic migration. I'll have to take a look at that now.
So Aaron Jensen had a question on Twitter. He said, what's the benefit of abstracting SQL? Isn't SQL already a DSL?
So the benefit is that you further abstract back the touching in the same way that in Hibernate abstracts out what database you're actually using, what database technology, like MySQL or SQL Server or SQLite. You get the same thing from using a migration framework, that you can run migrations while doing testing in SQLite. You can then deploy to development, to a dev environment using MySQL or SQL Server, and it further abstracts that. That's one area that I've found a lot of use in it, in using it in testing with SQLite and then using it to in production with SQL Server, other things. And you get that with Rails migrations. I think pretty much all migration frameworks have some abstraction between the database and the actual API. Now, if it was a framework that was bound to a specific type of database, then you wouldn't really get that abstraction. But that's where I see benefit in doing that, because I'm not binding myself. If an Hibernate's not binding me to an actual database vendor, then I don't want to. I want to touch it as small as possible. But of course, once you get into SPROCs and functions and things like that, then you have to bind yourself to the technology at some point. And maybe this is one of those arguments. And I know people say it a lot in Hibernate. Oh, well, you're not bound to any specific database technology. And people say, well, how often are you going to actually switch your production database? So this may just, not be a valid argument, but it's one that I've found use in abstracting away from that.
Well, so I think one of the good points is that if you're careful with your abstractions and your layer, in your model, you could in theory use SQLite in dev or, you know, some other, you know, local database, lightweight database, and then use SQL Server in test and production and not have to, you know, go through the hassle of sticking to straight, you know, ANSI standard SQL, which, you know, you can do it, but
do you want to?
Well, one other thing too is you know, if one benefit of kind of using a framework like this is then you don't have to think about the syntax between different projects even. Like if you're always writing your migrations using a system that you're used to, then you can hop back and forth between different databases on different projects and not have to, you know, switch gears. And I've seen that be more useful in the past than actually on one project switching back and forth.
Well, I think we've about reached a 1 hour point. So
amazingly.
Yeah, that went quick.
Yeah.
We could go one of two directions. We could start to wrap things up, or if you guys wanted to do a
lightning round
kind of thing.
Oh, the lightning round's always fun.
Yeah, we can do that. Yeah, definitely.
All right, cool.
As long as there's no lightning involved.
No, it's more like long, slow soliloquies. All right. Yeah, the molasses round. Okay, I brought it up. All right. So last summer, Sean, you wrote a really excellent series of posts called The 31 Days of Refactoring. And that kind of made me wonder, and this is part of the lightning round, so I'll ask everyone this question, but we'll start with you. What refactoring operation do you find yourself using the most?
That's actually a really good question. And the one that I find myself using the most, not the one that I like using the most, is probably it's probably something as simple as rename. I mean, rename, and as I stated in that series that I had, which was, I might add, extremely painful to, I was amazed that I pulled it off. was the rename refactor, I think, is very underrated, because I'm one of those people, you know, Dave Donaldson, we constantly made fun of him because he would mull over, is this method named correctly? Let's think about this for 5 minutes. But it's actually a really good thing to get in the practice of, and renaming things a couple times and not too much to convey the intent. And it's important, I find, to use renaming as much as possible so that I can better refine what it is I'm trying to communicate to the next programmer, because I really try to think about the next guy that's going to come along, and that's where the rename factoring really comes in, because I want to make sure he looks at the method and says, okay, I understand what that does, and I don't have to dive into it. So I think that one is very important, as well as the extract method. I probably use just as much, if not more, than rename. The one I like to use the most, though, is probably, refactor, like to strategy pattern or you know, switch to strategy. I love removing those switch statements and putting it to a strategy instead. That's always very pleasing, but I don't get to use that one as often.
Yeah. What about Scott Kuhn?
So I don't know what the resharper command is, but in CodeRush, it's move type to file. Simply because whenever I'm writing tests or writing methods, I'm always just typing in the names and types of things, you know, that I think I'm going to need, and then they don't exist yet. So I say, okay, you know, create, you know, type, create class, create whatever, and then it just plops it in the same file. So I go up and I say move type to file. I use that all the time. It's always in conjunction with, you know, create type.
Kevin?
Oh, I think I have to be unoriginal here and go with the extract method. I'm big into, you know, breaking things down into small digestible chunks. So
cool. John?
Yeah, I was going to say the extract method, too. I do that a lot. My favorite, I think, is getting rid of ifs and fors and any kind of, like, loop, and trying to see if I can use a, link or some other method that'll kind of, you know, get rid of those blocks. Usually because when I do that, then I find that there's a better way to be solving the problem anyways.
I have to be a little bit unoriginal, too, and go with rename. When I came up with this question, actually, I was in the process of renaming a bunch of things because I actually had worked enough on the problem to understand what the problem actually was, and was going through and cleaning things up by renaming things. So not a great lightning round question.
So what have we learned from this? That I'm the only one that writes this code right the first time.
Excellent. All right, coming back at you, John. What's your favorite virtual machine software?
Well, I have a new favorite, VirtualBox. I know people have been using this for a long time. I just stuck with VirtualPC for a while because it was simple, but VirtualBox, I tried it recently. It's just working really, really smoothly, and so I'm a big fan now.
Kevin?
Oh, VMware for me, for sure. A longtime user of VMware Workstation. It's it's not free, and so a lot of people don't pick it for that reason, but for the amount that I use it, that totally pays for itself. It's got just some amazing features that none of the other... Well, I haven't used VirtualBox, but certainly VirtualPC doesn't have, and it's just way faster than VirtualPC, so no-brainer to me.
What about you, Scott?
VirtualBox.
Long-time user?
Long time. Actually, it was Ted Leung that introduced it to me kind of on Twitter. He said, look, they came out with a new version. I said, oh, I should try that. And it's been pretty much VirtualBox ever since. It's cross-platform. I don't know, VMware and some of those other ones are as well. But it's kind of the same cross-platform. It allows for 64-bit hosts or 64-bit guests. And it has actual 64-bit host, which is nice. But really, yeah, it's a lot of little things, like the ability to remote desktop into any virtual machine, regardless of what the host is running. It's not the fastest in the world, but it's better than nothing. And if you're on a LAN, it's fine. And it's just been really stable, and it seems like every version it gets a little better. Snapshots are awesome in it too.
Well, what about you, Sean?
I would definitely say VirtualBox. I've used both VirtualBox and VMware quite extensively, and a lot of times I use VirtualBox for Linux guests because I do toy around or kind of smack my head against the wall in Ruby quite often. So whenever I do that, I do that in Ubuntu guest OS. And doing it both on VirtualBox and VMware, it just seems like VirtualBox runs Linux guests much, much better than VMware does. I don't really have that many Windows VMs, but I do have quite a number of Linux VMs, so it comes in really useful for that. And plus, ever since Sun picked up the development for it, it just seems to have gotten a lot better and a lot more stable. I think they added 64-bit support after Sun picked it up, but just in the last year, 2 years, it's getting a lot better than it was prior to that. So definitely VirtualBox.
For myself, I guess I'm in sync with John Galloway. So John just got an Android phone recently, and I just got an Android phone recently, and John just started using VirtualBox recently, and I just started using VirtualBox recently. It's kind of weird.
I don't know how that could have happened.
I tried it for the first time, I guess it was about a month ago, and I'm still not using it day to day because I still have to get some of my other virtual machines moved over to it without getting them to reactivate in blue screen, so I'll probably just rebuild them. I like the seamless mode. Does VMware have that? Something like that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's slick. All right, so last question, and we'll hit Sean up again with this one first. Speaking of androids, what is your favorite movie that involves an android?
If I have to say a movie, I would probably say iRobot, because the robots are so, in that movie, they're just so emotionless and evil that they play a very good robot. I would have said something like Blade Runner, but compared to the book definitely paints the androids to be much, much better, in my opinion, than they were in the movie. But if we're talking strictly movies, which we are, then I would say iRobot, definitely.
Scott Kuhn. Scott Kuhn says JavaScript. All right, moving on.
I'm going to go with Heartbeeps.
Heartbeeps.
Starred Andy Kaufman and Bernadette Peters. And it was so incredibly, horribly bad that it was entertaining. And it was Andy Kaufman. So you just were never sure if he knew it was going to be this bad and he was doing it to make us laugh.
Interesting. Alrighty. That's going to send everyone to IMDb. 4.1 stars out of 10 there. Kevin.
Good Lord. I don't know that I have a favorite movie about androids. Star Trek Next Generation movie. How about that one?
All right.
Data.
What about John?
Yeah, I'm going to say Blade Runner. So I didn't read the book, so I don't know what I'm missing. And I first saw it, a friend drugged me along to his film class, and the the teacher like explained all kinds of things about it. And so it was a very deep movie. I mean, I appreciated it quite a bit. So, yeah, it's my favorite.
Cool. Well, for myself, I'm just going to go with the Terminator movies, all of them, especially the ones that have Guns N' Roses music in them.
Hey, hang on. Those are cyborgs. You said androids.
They are? Oh.
Cyberdyne manufacturers.
Cyberdyne. Yeah. I'm still going with Terminator. Well, I guess that's a wrap then. Thanks for being on the show, Sean. Is there anything you want to plug? Anything exciting coming up?
I don't believe so. The one thing that I would like to say is to thank the two other main committers on Fluent Migrator. Without Josh Kaufman and Steve Hodges, it wouldn't have actually gotten to the running state. Nate and Justin and I took it to a certain degree and then kind of dropped it on its head. So they came in and picked it up and brought it to fruition. So I really got to throw out a thanks to them. Otherwise, we wouldn't be where we're at now with it. So other than that, I don't think I have any plugs for anything at the moment.
All right. Well, thanks for being on the show. And thank you for listening, everybody. Tune in again for the next episode of Herding Code. Drum roll.